That was Yo-Yo Ma and Maximilian Harnong doing a piece composed by my guest today on the Create and Grow podcast, Jose Elizondo. I'm so excited to introduce you to him, his story, and how he's the epitome of intercultural creativity. I'm Janine, your host of this wonderful show and your intercultural creativity keynote speaker, where this is the intersection between cultural competence and creative thinking. Now sit back, relax, and enjoy this episode about how to compose a life well lived. Welcome to the Create and Grow podcast. We are so excited to be with you in this new year of 2022. I bring to you the top minds that I'm aware of and that the world is aware of, and today is no different. I have with me Jose Elizondo, who is the epitome of what my work is about. I am a pioneer in the world of intercultural creativity and intercultural neural creativity. And once I met him and heard of his story, I knew I had to bring his story to the forefront and bring him directly to you so you can see what a walking example, what a manifestation, incarnate example of intercultural creativity looks like. Welcome to the Create and Grow podcast, Mr. Jose.
Hi, it's so great to see you. Thank you so much for inviting me. I'm very happy to be here.
So I'm going to give a quick teaser as before you give your story that you're a composer. You have composed for Yo-Yo Ma, for Sheku, who's in London, who performed at the royal wedding of Prince Harry and his beautiful wife. And you have met one of my favorite composers, Arturo Marquez, who wrote the Danzón No. 2. And I use that music with my students and my clients to help with emotional intelligence. And we're going to talk all about that later on. I just wanted to throw that out there so people knew why they need to listen. But at the same time, you also have your engineering degree from MIT, and you were co-attending MIT for engineering and music at Harvard. Oh my goodness, who is this person that we have in here? Can you give our audience just from not necessarily day one, like you were born, but where did you come from and what was a route that got you to where you are today? And then we're going to dive in about how your life is the epitome of intercultural creativity.
Wow. Well, thank you very much for that wonderful introduction. I'm originally from Northern Mexico, from a family that was, my father was a producer of potatoes, and my family was into the commercialization of the potatoes. And my mother's side, it was a family of coal miners. And I was very fortunate to be introduced to music at an early age. And I was also quite a determined student when I was young. And after several circumstances, that helped me basically to fall in love with reading, with math, with music, I was able to apply to the universities in the United States and come to this wonderful country. And I spent quite a considerable time in Boston, studying, as you said, at MIT. I was very blessed to be there and meet some wonderful people. At the time, I was studying electrical engineering and computer science, and I was thrilled to be able to learn, from such an extraordinary institution and with teachers like Amar Bose, the creator of the Bose Company. And it was such an incredibly stimulating place. I mean, just all my classmates who have gone on to do extraordinary things with their lives, was a very compelling and inspiring place. And I was blessed also, as you mentioned, to have the opportunity to study some music at Harvard. I mean, I also studied music at MIT. In fact, my main teachers at MIT were Professor Peter Child, Professor Edward Cohen. And then at Harvard, I did mostly conducting, choir conducting with Jameson Marvin, Constance Fotis, and some orchestra conducting. And then when I started my professional life, after a short stint teaching in Mexico, because I went back, for 6 months, I came back to the US and I started to work basically in the technology that I'm still working at right now. This company does speech recognition technology, very exciting stuff. We introduced a lot of this technology to the market, and you know, a lot of the work we did is basically why we now have virtual assistants and all of these ways to interact with machines in a natural form with speech. And at the same time, I was basically very blessed to be able to explore my creative side with music, and it went through some really wonderful, unexpected circumstances that led me from somebody who loved music deeply and who thought that music was going to be my companion, but wasn't sure how, because I had actually injured my hands. I could no longer play the piano, that was my like original dream in terms of music. But life basically opened a different set of doors than what I was expecting, and I ended up becoming a composer. With very little training as a composer, I had more training in other areas, but it was such a blessing the way that circumstances played out, that they led to meeting people like Carlos Prieto, who's the most iconic musician in Mexico and one of the greatest in the world. And then through him, I had the opportunity to hear my music performed by the living legend, Maestro Yo-Yo Ma, which is just, you know, one of the most biggest blessings in my life.
We're going to jump in there because there's just so much there. Let's go back to your dream of being a pianist, right? And you play the piano, and then tragedy strikes. In my classroom, I used the story of Beethoven to teach not just my students, you know, they learn the recorder, they do Ode to Joy, you know, his ninth, they listen to his third, but we also talk about his life struggle of how he started to lose his hearing and then switch. So immediately when I heard your story, I thought about Beethoven and how some of his greatest works were after he was completely deaf. Talk about what was going through your mind when you were struggling with your hands failing.
Yes, well, I mean, it may sound trivial to some, right? Like, okay, yeah, he had an injury. But it was more than just basically about being able to play. It was about identity, and it was about a big coping mechanism for me. Music had been my refuge. There were some difficult circumstances during my childhood. We don't need to go into that, but music was one of the places where I felt safe, where I felt it was a space that was nurturing. It was a space that healed me and that allowed me to have a place of expression. And it was one of the reasons why I'm here now. and so to go from a period where I was giving many recitals, per year, and where that was how I saw myself, as I was, you know, a performer. I was a pianist. I was also playing the organ at the time. And it was a very big part of my identity. So all of a sudden, when my hands were injured and I could no longer do that, you know, after 10 minutes, I would be in horrible pain for days. All of a sudden, that huge part of me is like gone. It's not accessible anymore. And so I had to, this one of the many times in my life where I had to rediscover who I really was, what I could do, what I couldn't do. And sometimes those discoveries happen intentionally and, you know, you work on them. Sometimes they happen unexpectedly and they bring wonderful surprises into your life that you hadn't even considered and that, you know, turn out to be quite a luminous way to find a path of meaning. And that's what happened with composition. And for me, it was an accident, happy accident.
The happy accident. And my job here is to connect the dots for our audience. Now, my seven gems of intercultural creativity, number one, you know, mindset, and then empathy, being open-minded. Then third one is observation, curiosity, perspective shifting. And the sixth one is authentic adaptation. Like, how do you adapt? There's cultural adaptations, adapting to different groups, but there also is crisis adaptations. Right now, we're in a huge time area of adaptation. People are being forced to adapt because of what's going on in the world. And you said that you've had many of these times of where you've had to quickly adapt or just for whatever reason. Do you think your music and arts background gave you the muscles to adapt well? Because in music, especially improvisational music, I know you're classically trained, but I don't know if you've ever done, you know, improvisational music where you just sat down and played. How do you deal with adapting in your musical training and any other arts that you may have partaken of, and how do you transfer that into life adaptation?
There's so much that could be said on this topic. With regards to just adapting to a tragedy or a new situation, let's not call it tragedy, because honestly, it opened so many wonderful doors for me. But at the time, it felt, like a major change. I think for that, I would say it was more basically the very peculiar background I had in terms of my family, and like having seen both of my parents, who were extremely resourceful, extremely creative and intelligent people in their own ways, and seeing how they faced so many challenges in life, that I was able to basically always see life in a way where, like, you know, you don't even consider giving up. You just basically find a new way and you work really hard at it. And then you basically, you eventually, hopefully, find a way to make that your new reality, to do the best with it. But in terms of the improvisational stuff of music, I would say if we go a little bit further in time to my music career, if we can call it that way, because, you know, like I've had a very peculiar path. So I don't know if it's like a standard career, but it's been a lot of adaptation because, I never expected to be a composer. When I got my first commission from Mr. Prieto for the piece for two cellos, I had never written for cello before. And many times when I have been given extraordinary opportunities, and I've been very blessed to have been given some extraordinary opportunities, it has been basically about taking the challenge and learning in order to be able to be prepared to do it. Because it's often been above where I am at the time, and basically having to work through the fear, work creatively to find a way to fill in the gaps. Like, if you don't know about cello, well, you learn about cello. Look at the compositions of the great masters and try to see what they did. You talk to people, you find people that are willing to try out what you're writing. And hopefully then you're able to present something that is worthy of the task that you were given. And it's a very, scary process, but it can be also a great way to grow. I see this, every challenge I've had has been basically a wonderful opportunity to grow. And in a sense, like a master class on whatever I didn't know before.
I love that. I love that. And so you went through the change of moving from piano to composition, and then out of nowhere, someone asked you to compose for cello, and you were so could you talk a little bit more about that and how that eventually got you to Yo-Yo Ma and Mr. Sheku, who I love, his whole family.
They're so amazing, all of them. Well, thank you for asking about that. This is, I love talking about this. So I was very blessed that, my music teachers were very patient with me, and they were very nurturing, and they were very encouraging, particularly with regards to exploring music that was genuine to me. Like, even though I was supposed to be in a class where I should be writing music that was either academic or, more like avant-garde and stuff, they embraced the fact that I was interested in exploring my roots and that I was interested in exploring my Mexican identity. And that was very empowering, and it was, a wonderful thing that I'm very grateful for. So I have written one orchestra piece as a homework for one of the very few composition classes I took at MIT. And one of the biggest icons in classical music in Mexico, Mr. Carlos Prieto, came to visit MIT because he was also an alum. He had studied economics and material science and then went on to become one of the most successful entrepreneurs in Mexico, president of several banks, so the biggest steel foundry in Mexico, but also the most prominent cellist at the time in Latin America, friend of Stravinsky, Shostakovich, And just an incredible human being.
And but, so wait, like, really? So he was a financial guru and a renowned musician at the same time.
Yes.
So are people seeing the connections here? Connections, people.
And an engineer, let's not forget, not just an engineer. I mean, he had a very extraordinary education in engineering, and he was just a very brilliant man. And also, he's passionate about reading. Reading is a very, very big thing in life. And in any case, so I admire him so much. He came to MIT to give a concert. I go there as a fan. And as I'm talking to him, asking him for an autograph, I'm like, could you please, Mr. Prieto, give me an autograph? And he's like, sure, who do I make it to? And I'm like, Jose Elizondo. He's like, oh, Jose Elizondo, I think I spoke with your teacher last night. And they showed me like your composition for orchestra. I really like it. Why don't we have lunch tomorrow? I was blown away. I mean, this is my idol, you know? And so I went there and I remember just being so excited and so inspired by him because he's such a presence. And then he tells me, would you consider writing a piece for me? And he says, for a concert that I'm hoping to do with Yo-Yo Ma. And I thought I was dreaming. I was not even sure I had heard correctly. It was just so beyond my dreams. This was just such an extraordinary thing, right? And like an out-of-body experience, really.
I'm going to jump in really quick, so don't forget where you are. I want to make the point that in this next era, before for sure, but definitely now, your resources and a lot of your growth experiences come through your ability to make relationships. If you would have missed that moment to get up and walk and introduce yourself to that person, you would have missed all of these dominoes effect. And really quick, a quick thing before you continue on. I went to the library for their 50th like anniversary, right? And the mayor happened to be talking. So I'm like, you know what? My three-year-old son is here. We're just going to go up and introduce ourselves to the mayor because I want him to know that whether it's someone living in a tent or it's the mayor, you treat everyone with respect and you look at them in the eye and you say hi, right? Yeah. And so we introduce ourselves to the mayor. And I said, yeah, he's just really into sprinklers. And my son, 3 years old, started to show the mayor around the library, pointing out all the water spigots, right? And then the mayor's like, you know, he's three. I've never seen anyone so into sprinklers. You know, I'm going to set up my office to have him go to the Parks and Rec. And basically, the mayor and his team set up a whole day of sprinklers. I'll send you the video. Wow. And the Parks and Rec, everyone showed Sean around, showed them how to use a sprinkler. They're building a lake and they let Sean get in the truck and put water down in the lake. All because we took the moment to introduce ourselves and say hi. So people, what moments are you missing because we're not making these intercultural connections? Carry on.
You are so right. If you don't knock on those doors, you don't know if they're going to open, right? I mean, what's the worst that can happen? You go say hi, you go and ask for an autograph and, you know, right. But if you don't even do that, you don't open yourself to a whole path of wonderful things that you may not even have expected, right? So I agree with you. And a lot of my path in music has been knocking on many doors that everybody thought were unattainable or like that were like unlikely, and then being surprised by how gracious and generous people are when they see that there's genuine interest. And also just being generous with compliments, because you know, when you see somebody extraordinary, a lot of people are like either too shy, too afraid, or, you know, people tend to just talk about people sometimes when there's something to criticize or something weird or peculiar, or whatever. Why not celebrate, you know, somebody who has been an influence in your life by telling them so and letting them know that the wonderful impact they have and how much you value that? That can have these unexpected, wonderful consequences.
And that's why I wanted him to know that whether it's the mayor or anyone on the street, we treat them with respect. But you're right. We have to say they're people too. They, you know, do the same things that we do, and to connect with them and to say how much that you have affected my life and my learning. Wow, what a thing. Because after a while, the money doesn't do it. But knowing mm-hmm. that your work has affected someone else's life, like that's gold right there. So, okay, continue in. You have lunch with him, and then what's next?
And so he gives me this commission, and I, of course, you know, inside I was panicking. I'm like, you know, I've never written anything for cello. In the orchestra piece, you know, you write a very simple cello part, but like nothing with cello as a protagonist. And here I'm supposed to write for like two of the greatest virtuosos in the world. And of course it has to be good, it has to be beautiful, but it also has to be non-trivial so that they're interested, right? And so I'm like, oh my goodness, right? And I had never played any string instrument. I was very blessed that I didn't freeze or that I wasn't too intimidated. And I just saw on him somebody with grace and kindness who was, you know, offering an opportunity. And again, what's the worst that can happen? You do it, and if it doesn't work, it doesn't work, right? But if you don't even do it, you don't know if it's going to work. So you must, you know, when the opportunities present themselves, and they don't come often sometimes, right? You have to try them, and you have to do your best. And if you do it genuinely, you know, at the very least, you will learn. Even if like things don't work out exactly in the best way, but sometimes they work out much better than what you expect. So in any case, I write this piece, and I'm very blessed that, you know, Mr. Prieto liked it and that he embraced it and that he was playing it. And I was also very persistent at the time. I was very fearless, partly because I was young, partly because I really didn't know the world of classical music. And just like I had done with my orchestra piece, where, you know, especially when you're a student, you don't send things around like normal. That's not the normal path. You don't just approach anyone and say, hey, would you play a piece? Because, you know, most likely they get hundreds of requests by much better composers, more established composers. And they have plenty to choose from. Like, why would they go with an unknown kid, right? And particularly, you know, in that at the time, it was very difficult to envision for me a Mexican composer, a living Mexican composer approaching these world figures, because a lot of the people that I had studied, right, were like these legendary composers that seemed larger than life and that, you know, had been in the Paris Conservatory and here and there and all of that. And that did not sound like me, but I was, you know, again, very persistent. And so I wrote to everybody and their mother, basically. And among these people, there was this extraordinary cellist, Guy Johnston in the UK, a very, very, extraordinary artist, but also kind and wonderful person. He seemed to quite genuinely like my Danzas Latinoamericanas, which is the piece that I wrote for Mr. Prieto. And a couple of years passed. I mean, he expressed that he had interest in it. And then, you know, I thought, okay, he was being kind and I'm glad that he saw it. And, you know, as like, you know, I had written to so many people who hadn't either responded or had said, oh, sure, you know, I'll play it. And then nothing happened. But with Guy, he truly, you know, sort of was very happy to embrace this new piece and sort of, you know, help this young composer. And he was at the time doing, you know, cello duets with Checo. This is prior to the royal wedding. And so the royal wedding happens and all that. And then all of a sudden, I see in one of my Google alerts that there's Checo and my name in a Google alert. And I'm like, wait, what? Right? And so I take a look and he's about to play at the Cello Biennale in Amsterdam, an incredibly extraordinary event where all these cellists come together. And I couldn't believe my eyes. And I'm like, really? Like, is this happening? You know, because I had already, you know, had my biggest idol, Yo-Yo Ma play, you know, the piece, and Carlos Prieto, my you know, childhood idol. And so in any case, it was so riveting. And so I contacted Checo, and I find out that he had actually been given my piece by Guy. And then later, actually, he played it with Guy in several concerts. And it was life-changing in both cases because, you know, when you have people like that perform your music and you see the potential that you couldn't even imagine in your pieces because of the extraordinary artistry that they bring into it and how they make it something bigger than what you imagined. And also because, you know, their visibility, of course, you know, like these are very respected artists, you know, extraordinary people. People start to pay attention and people start to say like, oh, well, you know, that's a nice piece. I mean, if such and such played it, then let's see, let's take a closer look, right?
It's not just give him a shot.
Yeah, exactly. And so things started to happen and I've been so blessed by so many incredibly talented cellists and musicians of other instruments as well that have given me opportunities like that, just to take a look at my pieces or like ask for new compositions for really extraordinary events.
I'm one degree away from Yo-Yo Ma and Sheku. How awesome is that? And I'm definitely going to, if you have them or we can look for them, share the links to any of these pieces if you have them available, because I'm all about experiential learning, right? Having people now go in and listen to these works that you created and had other people help you bring to life. And I love the point when you talked about, yes, I created this beautiful piece, but hearing their interpretation and their creativity and artistry and perspectives on the piece that I created. I mentioned to you before, because I do study classical music and I also teach it to younger students in my career, I now have the ear of, I can hear Beethoven's whatever symphony, third, his fifth or ninth, but I can hear the differences between the Boston feel. I'm from LA, so it's all about Gustavo Dudamel, right? But I can hear him play, but I can hear three or four different symphonies play the same piece and know that they're being played by different symphonies, but it's the same music. Before we move on and we go on to some other intercultural connections, I want to talk about your resilience, about how you mailed and wrote and tried to contact all of these people to say, I created this, you know, the words of Seth Godin, here, I made this. And to have people ignore you, ghost you, slam doors in your face, you know, a lot of people would have given up. You know, what kept you going? And do you feel having an arts background, especially like dancers who go to auditions and musicians go to auditions as well, right? To have the doors or people say no, how does that build you in other areas, in engineering and science and math, in your personal relationships? How does the no build who you are?
Yeah, well, I mean, it's an important skill to have, to be able to understand that rejection is not necessarily a reflection of your value or the value of your work. There's so many circumstantial things that can happen. In some cases, for example, I would write to people, and in some countries, it's just seen as like, you know, something taboo, something weird. Like, you know, why would you write me an unsolicited message and tell me that you have a new composition? And like, some people don't really know how the composition thing works, and like they, you know, only know how, like, you know, you go to the store and buy like dead composer's music. They don't know, like, how are you supposed to do this when you're a living composer, right? Like,
I love the fact you keep calling yourself a living composer. Sure. Like, oh, by the way, I'm not dead. I'm here.
It's a little bit of a difference, right? Like, you know, it's not like you're casually just going to run into my music. We composers don't typically have agents, right? I mean, if you're a performer, somebody can push your performance and tell people about you, and you can, you know, like go and show up and perform. And also there's thousands of composers, right? Like, you know, vying for attention. So you can't just be passive. You can't wait to be discovered. It cannot just be, something magical that happens just, you know. You have to put yourself out there, seek that discomfort of actually, basically is you're making yourself vulnerable. You're presenting something that, you know, could be criticized, could be, there could be so many responses that you don't, you know, enjoy. And yeah, I mean, I would say for every 50 letters I would send, I would probably only get like 8 responses. One of them might be like, you know, somebody telling me, you know, get lost and like never write to me again. You know, 6 other ones might be like, oh yeah, thank you. I'll look at it at some point. And then one of them might be, oh, you know, I actually like this piece. Thank you so much for writing it. I will consider it for my repertoire. And then out of like 20 of those, maybe I will reconsider it. Maybe 1 or 2 later on actually play it. So you have to be persistent. And I think I was blessed by ignorance in the sense that I did not know that this is not how things work. And so I knocked in every door. I was hyper persistent, perhaps more than people wanted me to be.
Blessed by ignorance. I love that, because in creativity training, we tell people that sometimes your expertise can actually hold you back because it limits your way and you're unable to see other alternatives and possible connections because I'm an expert in this. This is the way we do it. And this is the way it's always done. Yeah. Whereas someone who doesn't have a clue the way it's done, they're like, well, let's try this and let's try that.
Yes. Yeah. And you know, worst case scenario, you learn that that's not the way. And then you like, you know, redirect. But yeah, I mean, I was, as I said, you know, fearless sort of because I didn't know better. And also, to me, a rejection didn't mean the end of the world. I mean, I was very blessed to have my two careers. So I am getting, you know, a stable situation with regards to my income, my, you know, ability to make a living with as an engineer. I was very blessed by having that. Because it is very tough, particularly as a composer. I mean, you don't really make money as a composer. You have to do it for the love of it. And so, you know, for me, basically, if somebody played it, it was a blessing. It was like, you know, a magical, wonderful moment. If they didn't, it's like, okay, move on. You know, sometimes it's very disappointing when you really admire somebody and you really wish, you know, in your heart that they would play it, or you know that it's perfect for them if they listen to it, because you know you've seen what else they play or what else they do, and it's highly compatible with your message, and you know that they would shine playing your piece, and they just don't bother. But again, what do I lose, right? So I just keep trying and keep knocking on doors. And also the other adaptability aspect for me has been, so I write for cello, but the piece is, you know, like melodically written in a way that it doesn't depend just in the instrument. I mean, a lot of my music is melody driven. And so those melodies, if you make them memorable and you make them, basically in a particular way, you construct in a particular way, you can transfer them to other mediums. And so I have, for example, for the piece that I wrote for Mr. Prieto and Yoyoma, I have 62 versions of it. I joke with my friends that one of these days I'm going to arrange it for tuba and triangle, because everything else I have it for.
You know, call me. I have a picture of me playing a triangle. I'm your girl.
Excellent. Excellent. Yeah, but I have it for everything, like string quartet, orchestra, with or without piano, flute and oboe, saxophone, and you know, whatever, like everything you can imagine. And every time I, of course, you know, create something that speaks in that language, the language of that instrument, that is going to make that instrument shine, is not just a copy-paste situation, right? I rethink the composition. I make it so that, you know, it's particularly that it's going to be an experience that is going to be good for that instrument, where that instrument is going to shine because of its strengths. And also sometimes I even add like new little counter melodies or things to make a particular version special. And that has opened many more doors to me as a composer, because then a composition that might have originally been for two extremely virtuosic cellists now is also available to youth orchestras, or is now also available for, you know, flutists or for somebody else. And so that has been a big lesson for me, that not limiting yourself and adapting to what you see, where you see the opportunities, is big.
And that is a huge leadership lesson as well. I know a lot of my work is in leadership, and what does intercultural creativity look like as a leader, whether you're a leader of your home with, you know, your family, your children, you're leader of a classroom as an educator or facilitator, or you're a leader of in a corporation or an organization. And you said something that's clear. As you know, my background is in psychology, but I'm also into the neuroscience of how creativity works. And what we're looking now is how leaders and teachers can really lean towards asset-based teaching or asset-based leading, where you're more mindful of the strengths and the assets of the people that you're leading. And you have a wonderful parallel that you just said, that if I'm translating this for flute, for oboe, for the triangle, right? That's hilarious. Exactly. What are the assets of that instrument that I can bring forth and allow to shine? So in order for you to do that, you need to know something about the triangle, the flute, and the oboe, and whoever you're writing for.
Yes.
What are your thoughts about that?
Yeah, thank you for letting me talk about that, because it's also another wonderful thing that has happened in my life. So I, you know, as we have mentioned, so I had some training as a pianist and as an organ player, during my time at MIT and Harvard, I had learned something about conducting. I had learned something about music history. I had taken just a couple of composition lessons, but it was very basic, to be honest. I mean, obviously the teachers were wonderful and all that. But I'm just saying, it's not like I was in a conservatory and that I spent years, you know, honing in the craft and art of composition. I wish. But because I didn't have that, you know, whenever somebody would say, you know what, I really love your cello piece, but I want to play it in saxophone. If I had the time and the opportunity to do it, I would see it basically like, oh, you know, I have this extremely talented performer who's willing, you know, and predisposed to be open to this process. And I would talk to him and say, sure, you know, I'll do the adaptation, but can we work together to figure out what works in your instrument, what doesn't? And basically, I would end up with a masterclass on each of these instruments. And as, you know, time progresses, you hear different performances, you learn, oh, you know, like this melody that sounded really good in my mind, and even that is possible with the instrument, there's a technical thing that doesn't allow it to flow so well in this instrument. So why don't I try this other thing? And then you, you know, have the opportunity to start to learn like the intricacies of the instrument and, you know, in a way that I think even in a conservatory, you wouldn't get. So I was very blessed, again, that because of the popularity of some of the pieces and because people were already in love with them and wanted them to be able to play them themselves, I was able to sort of get this synergy where they would get the piece, the version they wanted, and I was able to grow as a composer by learning what works and what doesn't with an instrument. And it's infinitely better to do that when you can hear it with somebody real playing the piece and also somebody who's a virtuosic, because you know they already have mastered their instrument, and so you know that the issues that you might hear are with your music, not with them not being able to play a particular scale or something. And it's a wonderful learning experience. And so I basically have managed to get myself an education as a composer through these partnerships and collaborations with many extraordinarily generous and talented people.
See, and once again, that's just a wonderful leadership lesson, that not only are you leading well when you connect with people and see from their perspective, you know, their strengths and really communicate well, but you're also teaching yourself and you're growing from now having almost that, yeah, that masterclass in education, whatever their strengths are, as yeah. you learn to lead them well, you're also leading yourself well because you're now adding on that extra, for you, that extra instrument to your repertoire, but for leaders in, you know, finance or marketing mm-hmm. or whatever, that totally translates. So that is wonderful. I can talk for you for hours about music. The last thing I'll say before I want to switch into the intercultural connection of your cultural growth as well, which is astounding. You definitely want to hear this next section, is the fact that music, they found out with the whole journey of neuroscience, has really opened up our minds to what actually is going on in our brain. And they have discovered that, you know, it's not really a left brain, right brain, and oh, just creativity is only on the right side. And music, they are finally, with fMRI machines, they're seeing that the whole brain is lighting up when you listen to music, number one. But then when you take it a step far and you play music, because it's activating your motor yeah. cortices, your visual, your audio, there's so many parts of the brain that are being activated. So mm-hmm. they said that listening to music is really putting your brain into a party, but playing music is giving it a full brain workout. And it strengthens your corpus callosum, which is this middle section in the middle that attaches the two hemispheres. So it basically opens up the highways between your two hemispheres so they can connect and get ideas across and get connections yeah. across better. How do you think music has just helped you be a sharper person in non-musical areas of your life?
We could talk 4 hours about this. I mean, there's like the obvious aspects of, for example, of discipline. Because, you know, when you're especially training classically to be a performer, you understand that you're not going to get anything for free. That, you know, even for, you know, people who are prodigiously talented from an early age, but, you know, even, and also for us mortals, you know, you have to put in the hours. And so you get used to from a very early age, hopefully, because that's when the biggest benefit happens with music, to understand the power of discipline and work. The fact that, you know, you have to do it consistently and you have to do it every day, basically, to get your body and your mind to basically understand this language of music. And so that's a very obvious one. Another one is, of course, you know, if you're part of a string quartet or a choir or something, you understand basically team dynamics. You understand that, you know, you can't just think of as an individual. You have to listen to the other ones. You have to understand who has the lead at certain different points. When is your moment? When is not your moment? When you need to be supportive or where you have to lead? So many, many life lessons. But also in terms of the neurology that you were mentioning, I think that, you know, because music is like a language, right? It helps you to understand, you know, for your brain to understand how to work with abstractions. And also it has many side benefits. So for example, if you learn how to play the piano or the organ, you're going to have to learn how to read not just one line, like when you're reading in a book, but multiple lines at the same time. And each of these lines is in a different clef. So in a sense, you're translating in one way the symbols you see for your right hand and in a different way the ones for your left hand, and in the organ in a different way for your feet. And so, you know, you are engaging, first of all, the psychomotor connections of multiple parts of your body in different ways, independent. And so you create independent tracks in your mind. You're able to then do multi-track processing as you are, you know, making this part of your sort of like intuition mechanism, because you're not just thinking anymore, oh, I'm reading three things and all that. And imagine conductors reading like 20 or 30 lines at the same time, right? But then, you know, when you apply it to other areas, you're able to pay attention to multiple threads without getting so easily confused, where you're not like, oh my God, you just changed topics and what happened here? And there's another conversation here. And oh my God, I'm all confused. You're able to deal with that type of chaos much more easily, I find, because you're already, you know, basically accustomed to multi-processing and to basically having that independence. It opens your analytical abilities as well, because you're basically used to finding structure in what seems apparently not structural. Because when you listen to music, many people, you're like, oh, that's pretty. But it's not just pretty, right? And there's certain formal elements, and there's like a prosody to music. There's a syntax to music. There's all of these things that when you are a serious performer or a composer, you are basically speaking this language. And so your brain is used to taking input, trying to make sense of it, trying to, you know, find patterns in it. And so I think that just like learning languages at a very early age shapes your brain differently and allows you to make, you know, connections that, sure, you could do later in life, but not as easily. But in terms of music, it just opens so many neural paths that are going to be useful for math, for, you know, anything. Yeah, for language.
And just for life and for emotional intelligence, I shared that I have my son listen to the birds and listen to the melody of the birds and talk about, well, what do you think the bird is feeling? Is the bird, you know, anxious? Is the bird happy or excited about something? You know, just by the musical element. And so for you to be composing music necessarily without lyrics per se, and having to communicate an emotional idea without having to use an actual word, like what are some things that, like, how do you start that process?
That's very difficult, but it's, yeah, you're right. I mean, I will first talk about it from the performer's perspective, and then I'll go back to your question, the composition. I think basically well, depends on your level, right? If you're just starting, maybe you're not yet engaged at this level, but when you have been doing performance for a while and you have mastered the technical aspects and you can get into the emotional, you know, so transmitting an idea and stuff like that, it forces you to understand emotions that are not yours. So if you're playing a piece that is a lament, something about something really tragic, right? Maybe you didn't have tragedy in your life, but if you don't make an attempt to connect with these feelings and you don't try to understand them and then project them to yourself, you're not going to be successful in playing that piece. Or it's just going to sound like, oh, pretty, but like, you know, like whatever. No, it's not going to be a great performance. But, you know, so it forces you to be able to understand emotions that are not yours, to feel emotions that are not yours. And so it gives you empathy. It gives you compassion. It gives you also, you know, a sense, it plays out in your mind the resolution of conflict as well, because a lot of music is, you know, it builds up drama. There's this tension of different things and there's this resolution and whatever. And so your brain gets used to also sort of like dealing with these paths of emotional sort of journeys and stuff like that. And it's like when you read as well a lot, right? You understand a little bit better how some things might develop, or, you know, how some things work. I think it does prepare you, and it you know, basically it has to have some impact. I don't know exactly neurologically what impact it has, but it must have some impact, you know, as opposed to like never even trying, right, to embody those emotions from somebody else. As a composer, if I may take one more minute, the biggest challenge for me was recently in 2018 when I was asked to write a composition that was meant to be for two things. One was the 100th anniversary of the armistice that ended World War I, quite a major event in world history. And it was also going to be a composition played in a concert in honor of Pope Francis for an event where there was going to be hundreds of thousands of young people in Panama. And they were going to, you know, like they get together to be inspired and how to make the world a better place. And at the time, also, one of my brothers had passed away. And so I was like, how do I combine all of these very strong situations and make something out of that? I didn't want to write a tragic piece, oh, about the war and like how sad it was or whatever, or like a piece about just mourning, because even though that's where my heart was at the time. And then like, how do I relate this to like all these young people coming to try to make the world a better place? And I'm like, okay, well, what about, you know, focusing on the journey from darkness to light, because that's what happens, sort of like the war is this darkness. And then all of a sudden, you know, you come up with this armistice and like the world is now able to see like, oh, maybe there's hope, right? Maybe there's a chance for peace. At the same time, for somebody who's mourning, there comes a moment where after you have, you know, basically process all that grief and all that loss, you realize that life has to go on. And you're, if you're lucky enough to have people in your life that have compassion and love and all of that, their strength helps you to look up again and see the light of hope. And I'm like, and what is it that, you know, young people can do when they, you know, look at this world the way that we are giving it to them, you know, and they have all this willingness to make a better place? And I'm like, well, that's the definition of hope, right? Basically, this willingness to act with the expectation that something better will come out of it, right? And so if you're okay, so that can work as an allegory. And so I wrote a piece called The Dawn of Hope. And it's a piece that there's a moment that it acknowledges the pain. There's a moment where like the cello has this lament. It's almost the cello is crying in it for like just a brief moment. I didn't want to make it a sad piece. But then the music sort of like opens up into this major melody that is very luminous and very broad and very sweet. And it's like, you know, seeing basically the beams of light, you know, behind a mountain as the sun is rising. And I was very blessed that it came out, you know, okay. Because sometimes you can have the best ideas and then like nothing comes out. But in this case, I was very, very lucky, very fortunate. And the piece ended up being much better than I expected. I was blessed at the first performance with this incredible cellist, Sebastián Hurtado, and his unbelievably talented pianist wife, Pamela Hurtado, as well. They just basically sprinkled magic into this piece. And, you know, with their sensitivity, they transformed what I had written into something that was very moving. And I've been very blessed that this piece basically was, I've been receiving so many messages of how this piece has given a moment of consolation, a moment of solace, a moment of joy to many people that have been suffering through these pandemic times. And it's a blessing when you know as a composer that music is not just pretty, but it's somehow speaking to people and giving them this one moment, 1 minute of an experience that heals, that connects, that, you know, at least distracts. So, yeah.
I would say reprieve and almost a freedom of just life's burdens, right? It just releases us. And I'm so excited to go find that right now and link it up for our audience. Oh my goodness, I can talk to you way more about this. And just the last thing I'll say, and then we'll move on quickly. Music is a language, which is very true, a mathematical language as well. And also the power of what language, you know, English, Spanish, French, Italian, just language is what it does to the brain. But there's research that shows that people who have a musical background, and like you said before, the earlier you start, the better, because the brain is so plastic at the beginning of life, that humans who have an earlier start in music, they're actually more capable to be successful in tonal languages, just because they're extra sensitive to tones. Like Chinese is a tonal language. Japanese is a tonal language. So it's funny just watching my three-year-old, you know, because he's been in music class since he's been in my womb, because I was a music teacher. So he's been hearing scales and everything. But yeah, his ability to listen to his Japanese songs and repeat them right on pitch is phenomenal. Just, I was like, oh, well, because he's been in music and the brain is so quickly growing within the womb and quickly growing within the first year of life. So just a reminder to everyone listening, if you have anyone who's pregnant or who has infants, just find Jose's music and Bach, apparently, right? You said
not me. Get back. Go to the source. Bach, I mean, he's the source of inspiration for everything. And his music is so wonderful because not only is it beautiful, not only is it sophisticated, you know, in terms of like the form and all that, but because he's always using counterpoint and multiple voices, then your brain has to process multiple tracks and follow the different voices and their intricacies. And that is way more interesting and more beneficial, I would say, than following music that only has like a simple melody and then the rest doesn't really quite matter. So yes, go for Bach. Go for Bach for sure, or Brahms, or you know,
Beethoven. Awesome. Yeah. We're a Beethoven household, but I did start listening to more Bach after you said that. So another thing I want to just point out is about the intercultural part of intercultural creativity. The number one indicator of a highly creative person is openness to new experience. And the number one indicator of a highly interculturally competent person is openness to people with different lived experiences. You have a story about just opening your home and just traveling, something you're doing right now, basically. Can you talk to us about that? And then we'll quickly talk about how that has opened up your mind to just be more creative. So what was your life experience with that? And then the brain experience.
Yes, I was listening to NPR and there was this wonderful little sort of like audio essay about this crazy Australian guy who had left his hometown and decided to travel around the world. He was basically hitchhiking everywhere, except when he had to cross oceans and stuff like that. And he would never stay in a place more than one night. And he was just like kept going. And he did this for about 10 years. And as he was doing this, of course, he met every possible type of person, had all these extraordinary experiences, and wrote 3 books as he was traveling. I'm like, who is this guy? And it sounded to me like, you know, these extraordinary experiences you read in like 19th century novels and about these explorers that go like to South America, right? You know, all these places. And I'm like, oh, I'm going to learn more about this guy. So I go and check. And I thought that I found his website. This is many years ago, before like all these travel blogs existed and anything like that. And I write what I thought my email for, what I thought was just like, you know, to receive a newsletter or something. But actually, apparently, it was the space where like you would sort of volunteer to host the guy. And I get an email almost right back and says, oh, thank you so much for, you know, subscribing to my list. You know, I'm going to be in Boston on this, that date, you know, and thank you for offering to meet me. And I'm like, oh, whoops. What am I getting myself into, right?
So you accidentally, you're just after reaching out to him, but you accidentally filled out a form for to host him for the night.
Well, sort of like, I mean, it was sort of ambiguous, but I ended up basically like, you know, I'm from Northern Mexico. It's not, you know, like often like you just invite anyone. Oh yeah, come stay in my place, you know? And especially like in my family, it wouldn't have happened like that. So in any case, I end up hosting this guy and it's one of the most extraordinary experiences. The guy had all these extraordinary stories to tell about the places he'd seen, the people he had met. And I was like, oh my God, this is incredible. So I started to search online and say like, okay, maybe there's more people like these people. I would love to meet more of them and hear their stories.
And oh, awesome.
There were a couple of clubs at the time forming. One of them was called Hospitality Club and the other one was called Couchsurfing, where you basically volunteer to show your city to people who are traveling from other cities, other countries. And I signed up for these things and I ended up in the space of about 10 years, not just showing the city, but hosting close to 750 people. It got to be such a part of my identity, such an extraordinary way for me to learn and experience life and, you know, sort of like learn about my own prejudices and try to sort of like get over them and learn about other countries, practice languages. It was just such an extraordinary thing. It changed my life. And also when you travel, you're able to do the same. So you reach out to the people who live in that place and are part of that club and they do the same. They show you the place, they, you know, and I ended up making some lifelong friendships. I mean, some of my closest friends now I met through this and, you know, with one of them, we've traveled through the US for weeks. We traveled for 5 weeks in Brazil. We, you know, have traveled together in Europe. He hosted me for a month and a half in Hamburg. Like, it's just like incredible, you know, some of the things that you forge because these people are very genuine. These people are very generous and you learn so much from them. And so, yes, it life-changing experience. Travel and being open to travelers and their stories and learning from them is something I recommend to everybody.
Ah, that's so amazing. Of course, time's a little bit different right now with yes, the pandemic, but I totally understand it. And I love that because once you open your mind map to someone else's story, it opens up your imagination. Yes. And so now your brain has information and images, because when you talk and dialogue, and even if they show you pictures or whatever, your brain now can set up these schemas that you might not be able to do yourself at that time. But now you have some type of schematic foundation to relive basically their escapades, right? And their joys.
And you have points of reference, you know, like, for example, if you're just an engineer, right, or you're just a musician or just a whatever, you most likely will hang out with people from your same profession, or at least a lot of them. And you're very unlikely, I mean, you could, but it's not as frequent that you're going to meet people from very random backgrounds. I mean, I ended up hosting, you know, Tibetan monks, soldiers, Broadway actors, you know, people who came from Kazakhstan, from Siberia, from Congo, from, you know, all sorts of places. And when you know somebody, like in real life, you know, like, now I know an astrophysicist. Oh, now I know like a guy who, you know, lived in Libya under Gaddafi. Like, you know, you all these different things. All of a sudden, these things start to become real to you. And you, again, have points of reference that are not just, oh, something you saw in the media and like, you know, you don't know. You didn't pay attention because it was not part of your own context. It gives you points of reference and it also gives you empathy because you see these real people in real situations from different worldviews and how they are kind and generous and just like you or better. In my case, I learned so much and I had to really grow a lot through these experiences. So it's powerful, really. Like opening.
That's so good. That's so good. And it reminds me of the work that Dr. Daniel Siegel out of UCLA talks about. I don't know if it's his work, but he spoke about it, the in-group, out-out group, and how when your brain deems someone as the out-group, the lines in your brain of, you know, compassion and empathy kind of shut off. And so how do we get more people in the in-group so our brain can see, you know what? And one of the ways that they say that is to show pictures of them in their family, having family life and hearing their stories, and they're more likely to come, neurologically speaking, into your in-group. And so those lines of compassion and empathy are now turned on with them because they've made that switch. Yeah. So thank you so much for talking about that. Of course, I could talk to you way more, but I think you're one of the longest interviews I've ever had. And I love it. And I'm going to post all of it because it's all good. And it's so critical because my work now is focusing, of course, on intercultural creativity. And I do make the point that creativity isn't only artistry, but I still am a huge advocate saying we can't ignore artistry and the fact that we keep cutting the arts out for our kids. We're cutting out these critical components that are supposed to be laying the foundation for the rest of their interactions and cognitions and what have you. And we just don't see the importance, but hopefully now that will change with the research coming out and your work and the brain research and everything. And people are asking questions about what's next, what's going on. And so now's the time to really, really push this and to show that intercultural creativity is about connections with different people from different lived backgrounds, about our creative connections, which metaphorical thinking, reframing, all the creativity, cognitive strategies that I talk about, but also the artistic benefits that the arts bring us as well. It's all here to help us be better humans, creative humans, and be prepared for this future of work and life. So the last thing I do end with is a diamond. We are the gems here, right? The diamond is our logo. And if you weren't moving around so often, I could send you your diamond gift, but I can't even get anything. I couldn't even get my book to you because you're just jet setting. I had to send you the PDF copy.
Jet setting, but definitely living a nomadic life. It's exciting. Yes.
But we do end with a gem. So if there was one final just thought that you wanted to leave with the audience, what would that be?
That's a very challenging question, but I would say that being able to adapt to circumstances, it's a very important skill to have. You know, something may happen with your health, with your life, with the world in the pandemic, or something that you did not see coming. And all of a sudden, you're going to have a new set of circumstances, a new context. And you shouldn't be stuck basically wishing for the previous one, the previous circumstance you have, or trying to like transform everything back into what's comfortable. But you should try to see, okay, what are the new circumstances and how can I optimize what I have so that I can, you know, grow, so that I can do what I need to do, so that I can have the best possible situation with others. And this applies to your interpersonal relationships. It applies to your art, to your work. Being flexible and being able to adapt to circumstances, an extremely powerful and useful skill to have. And particularly in these days where, like, you know, life and the planet Earth is giving us so many interesting surprises, but also where we have technology at our disposal that allows us to make connections like this, you know, like something that was not possible before, and that can actually bring a lot of extraordinary experiences that we didn't expect. I mean, how many people connected during these pandemic times with audiences they didn't know they could reach before? Because they were so focused on like, oh, I'm going to just give my recital locally at, you know, this beautiful theater in my city. And all of a sudden they can't, and they're doing a recital from their home. Yes, but the whole world can watch. And all of a sudden, you know, like what you thought was a problem has become actually a powerful tool to expand your world. And so always see things as a challenge. How can I adapt and make the best out of this? Never see it as like, you know, oh my God, you know, this is limiting. How do I go back to my comfortable previous state? Yeah. So adaptability.
Wonderful. And definitely something that we can train with the arts and with practice, right? Mm-hmm. Practice makes progress, right? And I just am so honored. Our dear friend Acela Zamorano is the one who connected with us. And once again, the reason why we just reach out to people, and I was like, hey, this is what I'm doing. She was like, you need to meet Jose. I'm like, okay. And yeah, I am so happy.
She's such an amazing woman. She's an extraordinary person. Yes.
And her son is doing great works with the cello. I'll be excited to share hopefully some of his work as well and eventually get him on the show. But it's just so important for people to reach out to make connections, because now you get to know the work of your work, the work of the home of Eliziando. And just everything that you've been able to do and contribute. I really just thank you for taking the time today to share your story, to share your gift with the world and your wisdom, and to remind everyone, yes, wisdom, I will call it out.
I don't know that a lot of my friends would like envision that word next to my name, but
I see it.
You're very generous. You're very gracious and kind, and I appreciate it very much. It's such a joy to be with you. You make people feel so comfortable, and you're so wonderful in the way that you, you know, basically bring out all of these extraordinary questions so that we can share experiences and then frame them in such a way that, you know, I love it. I enjoy this interview very much. So thank you.
Oh, thank you. And I hope that you'll share it with your friends as well, because it's definitely a message that we need to get out there, that creativity is now the number one skill needed in the workforce. And how does your story add to the conversation, especially the marriage of the sciences, the math, and the music, right? There's a book title for you right there, right? And that's, I'm putting that in my keynote. Music is just as important as math. Theater is just as important as ELA, right? And the arts, the visual arts, are just as important as the historical data, because it's the arts that bring history to life. So on that note, thank you so much for joining us for the Create and Grow a podcast. We hope that you have a wonderful 2022 and that you will continue to come back to hear our stories, to see how intercultural creativity will be and is the skill needed for this next era. Have a wonderful rest of your day, your creative day, and we'll see you next time. Bye-bye. Thank you.